Have you ever wondered what life would be like if you're the very first growth hire at an early stage tech company? Well, in today's episode, we got to bring on Peter, who actually went through that very same experience, working for an early stage Silicon Valley tech company and watching it scale and having to really build up what that growth function is. He comes with a really awesome perspective of what does growth actually mean in the very early days of a very early stage company. And how does the role change over time as it scales? And then what was that experience like going all the way from zero to acquisition? We had a really great conversation that I can't wait for everyone to have a listen. So let's get started.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Growth Equation Podcast. We're here today with Peter Z. Peter Z is a real good friend of mine. I've personally had the privilege to know him and all his antics and all his successes and everything in between for the last, 15, 16 years since middle school. So it's pretty crazy to be interviewing him. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Rahul, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Peter has a really interesting story. He's actually also here from our hometown in Toronto, made his way to the States, has had amazing academic experiences and work experiences, being employee number 5 at a super fast-growing company in the Valley. In growth, so he's perfect guest for our podcast, and he's also back in Toronto now. So, Peter, before we jump into some of your specific stories and all, do you want to give us a quick background on yourself, and we'll take it from there?
Yeah, for sure. So, hey everyone, Peter here. I knew Rahul since middle school. We attended the same middle school and high school together. And when Rahul went down his path of Schulich University and then back to engineering sciences at U of T, I decided to go to McGill University. I pursued pre-med there for 4 years, but realized I really didn't like it. So switched to philosophy on a whim. Found out that I really enjoyed philosophy instead. So continued to do a master's program there at Columbia University in New York. That's when I first moved down to the United States. From there, I'm not sure if you guys know Rahul, Greg, but 2015, it was a big tech boom in New York City itself. I think Mayor Bloomberg called it a Silicon Alley at the time. And I got to meet a lot of tech folks there, and they connected me with some folks on the West Coast. So decided to, you know, take a chance, pack my bags, flew out to Silicon Valley and joined the startup as the 5th employee. And, you know, everything just kind of blew up from there. And for the next 3.5 years, I was at this really fast growing startup, like a roller coaster, right? Going after Series A, Series B, and we actually successfully sold that startup last month to HireVue. So that concluded that journey. And I'm doing an MBA program now at NYU Stern.
That's amazing. Yeah, I actually just noticed that earlier this morning that, wow, that's a quick turnaround. So you joined in like 2017. So you joined Alio in 2017. Was that around when it was founded, or had it been around for a little bit longer than that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the two founders, Sahil and Ankit, started this company called SaaS Labs 1 year before I joined. And at that time, they were operating a different business model and a different product idea. And then they realized that they would rather pivot into another tangential idea that kind of really took off during their first year. And then that became Alio. So I joined at the inception of Alio after the pivot.
Got it. We'll definitely rewind a little bit, but so you joined as the first member of the team in growth. That's right?
Yeah. So they hired 3 people out of Columbia at the same time. And all 3 of us were part of the same growth team. So we initiated the growth team together on the same day.
And like for the role that they hired you for, do you feel like you had experience, the relevant experience going to that role? Or were they hiring based on just like pure, you know, hey, this is a good person, we think we could train them? Or what was the situation like? Because as far as I know, growth wasn't, or at least tech growth roles, wasn't something that you were too involved in before.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rahul, you would also know this, you know, being the founder of Feedloop, when you first start, you really do have to wear a lot of multiple hats, and roles aren't defined because you have to do a lot of things at the same time, but just the common goal, right, of getting that growth rate. And so for me, that role was not defined whatsoever. It was called a business associate, but that essentially meant, hey, can we push this business out? And can we actually sell this product within the next 8 to 12 months to get our Series A? And then, so that was our goal.
Got it. Okay. I didn't know that. That's interesting. Business associate. That's pretty general. So when you ended up there, what was like your first task? What did you start doing when you got there?
That's a good question. Let me rewind the clock back to when I joined. Oh man. So I walked into the office. It had no windows. I didn't know if this is actually real. It was a surreal that, you know, I got to meet people. I thought I was walking into some trap or something. And the first thing we did was sit down, kind of speak with the co-founders. He's like, you know, just read some Wall Street Journal stuff on this industry, because none of us knew about the recruiting space. And then right afterwards, the second day, he's like, so how do you guys feel about cold calling and sales? And how do we hack the system in such a way that, you know, we can get customers at 10x less the price than our competitors? So everybody is trying to market to these customers for, let's say, you know, a random number, let's say $200 per lead. How do we do it at $20? So that was our goal for the first 6 to 8 months. How do we do it for extremely cheaply to get these leads? And then how do we convert them on sales calls, basically selling them a product that doesn't work at a massive ARR, which is like six figures per year. So it was a pretty cool goal, I guess. It made no sense to us. But you know, we were very passionate about it. The environment was amazing. Everybody was supportive. I think one of the best things that happened during that startup it was just we're very fortunate to have a good group of people to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. The team at that stage really, really matters. But you gotta finish the story. So did you end up doing that? Did you end up getting the acquisition cost down to $20?
No, absolutely not. We didn't do a 10x, but we did it up to, I think, at least 2 to 5x less the acquisition cost.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the amount we were spending just to get a lead was so minuscule compared to the competition. It was like so many. I'll tell you my day-to-day activity. I would begin my day sometimes at 7 a.m. to take calls from the East Coast, right? It's with a 3-hour difference, sometimes 6 a.m. to take in at 9. And then it would be a half an hour, a sales call, right? When I tried to understand what their problem was and try to push this product. And I'll have a half an hour buffer in between where I would just run inbound marketing and mostly on LinkedIn and Google and through email, right? And these are the things that just, it was just sales call, and then running inbound, sales call, running inbound. And the inbound marketing kept getting us more leads and we kept getting more people to call. And the whole thing, we completely automated through, you might know things like Calendly, Zapier, et cetera.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that's awesome. That's really great. I mean, inbound is, it's a difficult channel to get going, but once you do, it's awesome. It really starts running. So then, you know, in what time span was that? Was that like in your first like 3 or 6 months, or was that your whole job there? I imagine that it changed pretty fast after that.
It definitely changed. So this was our goal as the growth team, the three of us, and just give a bit more background. There were about, I think, 5 engineers at the time, 4 or 5 engineers and 3 growth team members. So the team was very lean, and it was lean for a very long time. I would say all the way up until a Series A, we were still very lean, like below 10 or 15 people. And I can maybe get into a bit of Series A for those who might not know. But so for the first few months, that's exclusively all we did. I think for this first 6 months, that was definitely all we did. And I was more in charge of the digital channels inbound. And I had another colleague who was in charge of email and another one who was in charge of cold calling. So that's all we did. And then when Series A came along, that completely switched, because then we got an infusion of capital. And then we could expand the teams, right? That means we wanted to hire more experienced people who have a specialized focus on one area. So we built out an inbound marketing team. We expanded our sales team to more experienced sales professionals. We started a customer success team because having these customers, as you might know, Rahul, from your Feedloop days, that the best source of revenue is always recurring revenue. And mm-hmm. So you want to help the existing customers build that relationship and expand with them. So we had to build out that team as well.
Mm-hmm. That's really great. So then you got to a Series A. I remember you telling me, like in your earlier days, like they had like no snacks there, nothing. Yeah. It was really scrappy.
It was definitely absolutely no snacks. But I did remember 2 luxuries they had. One was one of the rooms were it was next to the street, so I had one window, and everybody fought to be in that room just to see the real world outside. And the second one was, I don't know if we bought like a $50 refurbished TV off of Amazon or something, but that was our source of entertainment. Like late night, where we put on like a hockey game or a basketball game and just crowd around on the floor to do work while watching the game.
That's so cool. That's definitely how you do it. So that was like, it sounds like that was like 2017. Series A comes. What happens after that? Is it just like tons of hiring, tons of growth. What did your role become? What were kind of the new challenges?
Yeah, it was indeed a massive shift for the business. So a Series A, as you guys know, and I'm guessing, you know, your audience probably aware, but just a quick top level, you meet some investors in Silicon Valley. They're interested in investing in your growth, both financially and helping with strategy. So then you give up a certain percentage of your company for exchange of capital. And for us, we managed to get $8 million from pretty good investors at the time, including Google's AI fund, Gradient Ventures. And what happens then is as soon as Series A ends, right? People say pre-Series A, it's all about the founder and team market fit. So is your team able to secure these extremely difficult revenue sources with an unfinished product? Because if you can, then you know your team shows grit, your team can do it, you can hustle. After Series A, it's really about that product market fit. So now that you're trying to reach other customers, not just through your narrative and your touching story, but actually through a working product, you need a really solid team. I'm talking about business from marketing to sales to customer success. I'm talking about the product. You need to have a product manager now to really understand what the direction the product needs to go. So based on that, we built out these teams. And there, you can't wear all the hats anymore because now you're segmented. And you also need to be committed to the fact that by wearing multiple hats, you know, you're not as efficient as you can be. So for us, the three people in the growth team, we also had to specialize. Right? And that was tough for some of us. For me personally, it was very difficult. I enjoyed wearing multiple hats, but realized, you know, for the good of the startup, I need to find an area which I can specialize in. And for me, that was growth marketing. So I thought, okay, I managed to get a 5x decrease in the customer acquisition cost. Can I keep this as we scale? So that was my role. And one of my colleagues at the time, she went into operations. And she's like, how do I visualize this company from end to end and help make sure everything's as efficient as possible? And the third one went into product and he said, how can I, you know, make sure I can be a technical manager for these customers so that when they have problems, make sure that the product we deliver works.
And then just a question on that. You mentioned how now you've kind of transitioned into kind of growth marketing. When you were there, was your goal more around like, okay, how do we drive multi-channel diversification and scale it up that way? Or was it really just focusing on a specific goal? Like, okay, we need to acquire X number of customers at this type of customer acquisition cost.
That's a really good question. And the real answer is the latter, right? We just had one goal. We said for us to hit a certain revenue goal and a certain margin, we must have a customer acquisition cost of like below a certain threshold. And it was up to us to think about how do we do that. So we had a lot of autonomy, even post-Series A. Even when the marketing team expanded, a lot of us are having different ideas, strategizing how to hit that particular goal. And one of them is definitely multi-channel diversification. But to be honest, a lot of us were very new. I didn't learn anything about marketing. We hired some people did, but the majority of the startup was still very new and didn't have the existing domain knowledge. So in a sense, maybe we can touch on this later, but we might have fallen into a trap where we wanted to just do, hey, this is what worked pre-Series A. Let's just keep hammering on this. And hopefully it'll keep working after Series A. And then in the long term, that was actually not the good idea. That was not the best idea.
And why wasn't it the best idea?
One thing I quickly realized, give you one example. We relied on one channel, LinkedIn, because it was at the time a very untapped channel for marketing. A lot of people were using Google Ads, Facebook Ads, as you guys know, a lot of email. But LinkedIn was untapped, and we thought we can reach our audience with LinkedIn's segmentation at a very cheap cost, simply because there's no one on LinkedIn and no one to bid against us. So that was very successful. But then what happened was other competitors started to catch on, right? They started to look at us and said, man, they're getting some really cheap leads. We want to do the same. And then suddenly everybody's bidding for the same competitor. And then LinkedIn as a platform, their cost started skyrocketing for us. And because we focus all of our attention there, and we did not really think of diversification, we actually were in a panic mode for a few months, realizing that our costs kept climbing and there's no way to drive it down.
And would you say that your experience working at this company, as an example, very different for other places within the startup world, where it's kind of like a growth at all costs mentality? You know, I haven't run into a ton of companies that at a very early stage, they're really focused on their customer acquisition costs. do you think it was a growth at all cost mentality when you worked there, or was it some, or was do you think it had a different type of mentality?
I think my take on it was the mentality was, I don't think it would be at all cost, but it was definitely, I think our co-founders who, you know, had a lot of industry experience. So one of them was used to be a senior engagement manager at McKinsey. And the other one, Ankit, used to be a product manager at Google. They brought a level of discipline to growth. So I've met and networked with, you know, maybe other types of founders who didn't have that industry background, that corporate background. And for them, it was definitely growth at all costs. But for these two guys, they brought a kind of, you know, an objective goal to growth, which is, hey, we want to hit 3 to 3.5x growth year over year. Here's how we do it. One of the ways is to make sure that we are very conscious about the cost as well as the, you know, the top line. And they were able to kind of have this top-down culture, which was growth-focused, but I think from their experience, it didn't have to be at all cost. And we were still able to achieve this 3 to 3.5x growth year over year without just being one of those lavish spenders where, you know, it's forget about any cost, forget about any efficiency, let's just keep pushing money out into the market.
Peter, talk to us a little bit about some of if you can, about some of the metrics. And I'm most interested in like how they change and evolve. So you mentioned like a bunch of times, I guess one of the earlier ones was just getting the CAC as low as possible. But like as post Series A or like later, and I know you weren't with Elio all the way to the end, but how do the metrics evolve on at least on the growth marketing side? Were you looking at anything different, or talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a great question, since I was in the very beginning built out this pipe analytics pipeline. And what it was is essentially, since we only had, or rather inbound marketing give us the vast majority of our leads, the metrics, you know, you're all aware of, it's the number of visitors that first, you know, have access to your ad, the conversion to how many click, the conversion to how many after they click to your ad come to your landing page, and the conversion from your landing page to a specific action, such as schedule a demo or, you know, sign up for a newsletter, and the conversion of that onto a call, right? And this is where sales come in. And then from that, it would be conversion to first, second calls, and then a close. So we had this very, very tight analytical pipeline where we analyze this at the end of every day to see, hey, where are we dropping? And throughout this entire pipeline, whenever possible, there was always an A/B test running. So at every instance, I had at least two landing pages, at least 2 to 3 ads every single day, just running to see which ones is converting more. It is very unscientific, if I may add, because I did not have time, or rather have the discipline to go and really see, you know, statistically in terms of significance, you know, which one's performing better. But just with the data I had, like for example, one of them had X percent, but the other one had like X plus 5%. I just said, let's just go with this one. And I would just keep turning pages almost every few days. And because LinkedIn was such a new channel, and we were able to tap its potential, we had hundreds of people, you know, every day at least, sometimes thousands, coming to our landing pages. So I had enough sample size to make a call literally, you know, in 1 or 2 days, and just kept turning.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the volume issue, because, I mean, I really love A/B testing, but sometimes some pages just don't get enough traffic. I mean, obviously, your homepage is going to get the most, and that's probably where you start tweaking. But yeah, it sounds cool that if you have hundreds or thousands, at least, you know, thousands, that definitely helps. You can run meaningful tests. I'm always curious, like tooling wise, what did you use for some of these things? Like I imagine obviously like Google Analytics, and for your A/B tests, like just like Google Optimizer, or can you mention some of the pieces of software or tools or even anything you guys built internally that helped you run experiments and helped you grow and helped you track data?
You know, this is something I hope, you know, everybody takes home, is that it's extremely cheap and very customizable if you can spend the time to build it upfront. So I used, definitely, like you said, Google Analytics, you know, just to track page behavior. I also use Google Tag Manager, as you might know, which is a free software on top of Google Analytics to essentially track even deeper layer of behavior, including where people click, so on and so forth. For the A/B testing, as you mentioned correctly, Google Optimizer is one version. We've realized that the more tags you put on a page actually affects the page load speed by a little bit. And that ultimately at the end of a few months, or has an adverse impact on and conversion rate. So even to solve that, we decided to build a clean blank page off of HTML, a very simple page. And we used that instead. We actually contacted a high schooler, some guy from high school from Fremont, to build a page for us for a very good price and for good experience for him. And what else did we use? I think these were the biggest ones. Later on, we started using, you know, Google Data Studio and BigQuery to kind of connect all the different marketing sources together. But that was even after Series B. Just in the beginning, all these tools that I just mentioned are completely free, except for the high school kid.
Got it. That's great. I know we spent a good amount of time on your journey at Alio. I find it really fascinating, especially considering, you know, how much you saw from the earliest days. Before we kind of jump off of that topic and that part of your journey, was there anything else you wanted to add about your experience that was noteworthy or exciting? Any notable failures or anything like that?
Yeah, a few major takeaways I learned through this journey, and maybe this will be, you know, maybe Rahul, you've seen this as well. You do not need a fantastic product to help a customer. So when you're with a client and then you're speaking with them about, you know, their pain points, what you think your product is capable of, and this especially happens to product people, right? And the product managers, they envision their product going really far, solving all these needs. And then you realize their like main need, either strategically or financially, can just be, you know, accomplished with a portion of your product. So there is always this disconnect between business need and the vision of product managers. And for us, what I found is that, you know, you really don't need to have a spectacular product to solve a problem, right? You need to figure out what the problem is and what the right solution is, and then see whether your product covers that or whether you can build towards it, right? Because in the beginning, we had such a simple product. And I'm proud to say that because our engineers and product managers are extremely focused on making our simple product very effective. And that's what drew the initial revenue. We didn't have AI or NLP or any of the industry buzzwords, yet we got some of the biggest players in the industry. I'm talking about, like, you know, Walmart, Amazon, talking about Hilton Hotels, right? We didn't need any of the fancy stuff. They came out and said, like, how do they do this? And then our competitors who were banking on that fancy stuff did not get nowhere near as far as we did. So just be very cognizant of your customers and business needs versus what where you want your product to go. And the second one, I just want to quickly say, sorry to cut you off.
No, sorry. Go ahead. Absolutely.
Is that the initial team is... it's super important. So everybody knows that grit is important. You need to hustle in Silicon Valley. You need to be a hard worker. These are just given, right? But there is an element of luck that it's very difficult to control. And that comes from the market conditions as well as your team. So for anybody who's looking to join a startup or to begin their own startup, you need to figure out, one, right? Is the market acceptable to this? In that, is there a trend that you see, or can you create the trend that will be you know, accepted by the market in the next few years? And the second has to do with the team. It is so important. You're going to be leaning on your team members all the time. They're going to be leaning on you. If you have a team that gels together, the whole thing just clicks. If you don't, you're going to be taking a lot of time with internal problems rather than focusing the real goal at hand.
I really love that answer you gave there, especially when it comes to really around problems. Sometimes people focus too much on the solution and buzzwords that you mentioned. And really, I've always fundamentally believed it's like, what's the problem you're solving for? And understanding that really well. And then it's delivering on a solution that solves for that. Yeah. So I really loved your answer there. I think just transitioning a little bit now, it would be really great to get your perspective on your experience. You know, you spent a bunch of years working within Silicon Valley. You know, you've heard a lot of things about like that tech ecosystem. What do you think makes that place special? And the flip side of that, are there any things you are concerned about on that type of tech ecosystem that's based in that area?
Yeah, I'll address the special part first, and then definitely get into what I perceive to be some potential risks. So on the special side, I think it's generally true that Silicon Valley attracts a certain type of people than, say, from New York City. Just on the surface, not a lot of people wearing suits, tons of flip-flops around. Maybe it's a sunny weather, but I think it just attracts a different kind of culture. When you get to network with people in Silicon Valley, you see a lot of sparkles in their eyes thinking about how do we make the next big thing and transform the world in such an outlandish manner. And so it attracts a lot of these, I guess, like dreamers or people who may not fit in a corporate world, and they're able to find a voice and platform in Silicon Valley through startups, as well as corporations like Google and Apple, which even though they're very big now, and yes, they're a little bit more bureaucratic than startups, they still have these kind of startups within these organizations, startups within, like, for example, Google Cloud. Maybe a few years ago, you think about the Apple Watch, and they still do a really good job of fostering a community of these type of people. I think another thing that I really liked about Silicon Valley was just how open everybody was to sharing ideas. There is definitely a culture of open source, not just in terms of software, but also in terms of the business side and growth side, right? There is a growth community. People get together. They help each other. Here's a simple thing I did to hack for our startup. Here's what we did. And it's just a constant culture of collaboration. And it's been really helpful for our startup through my experience. In terms of risks, I think what part of the media say about Silicon Valley being a bubble is definitely true. The way that the ecosystem work is sometimes startups sell to each other, right? They build a solution that other startups might use. And the first early adopters, let me give you this case. Have you guys heard of Soylent?
Absolutely.
Okay. So Soylent's first crowd was Silicon Valley engineers, right? The founder said, I'm going to make a completely tasteless solution, right, with minimal ingredients for survival. And Silicon Valley engineers who are quirky will love it. And this, in a nutshell, is a lot of what Silicon Valley is, right? We build products for ourselves, but the biggest problem comes when you want to pass that bridge to, I guess, the real world or outside the bubble. And because Silicon Valley enforces a certain type of culture and people of a certain type of mentality come here, it's like a positive reinforcing loop where they keep just finding these people, the culture becomes a bit more separated. And then when you want to cross into reality, it becomes a little bit difficult. And then you'll see that there's movement away from Silicon Valley now, like people going to Austin, Texas, Peter Thiel setting shop in Los Angeles, people going to New York. And I think that's a result of the past 20 years of just Silicon Valley's huge boom and people realizing maybe they don't want to be in the bubble for too long anymore.
And then I guess one follow-up question out of that is, within that ecosystem, what is the viewpoint on thinking about sustainable growth, right? Usually what you see is it's like a growth at all costs. That tends to be how like venture capitalist funds work when funneling into different companies. Do you think it's changing or do you think it will ever change on that type of mentality of thinking about how you sustain growth?
That is a great, great point. And I can only speak for myself here. I think there's a couple of major events that has happened in the last decade that is forcing this growth at all costs mentality to shift. And let me point to three big ones. The first is Theranos. You guys might have heard of Elizabeth Holmes' startup, right? That was the quintessential growth at all costs. I'm going to grow so fast that I'm going to lie to the authorities and endanger the health of other people, right? They crashed. They crashed and burned. This was a signal, essentially, to Silicon Valley by their authorities that say, we can't allow this kind of growth anymore. And this has sent a huge shock down to everybody there because this wasn't a small startup. This was at one point valued at, I think, $9 billion valuation with leading investors. And so that was one major event. The second one, I think personally, was Uber, where Travis Kalanick, right, the ex-CEO of Uber, really saw insane growth from that platform over its competitors, over everyone. But he did it somewhat unethically. And you can read a lot of scandals about him. And he was eventually ousted by the board members who were composed of his previous investors. And that also sent a signal into that we can't allow this type of growth anymore. On the flip side, right, we have these two negative stories. You see Airbnb, who I think is one of the best leading examples or the companies that is willing to change. A couple of things they're doing. One is they just announced they're creating an endowment fund prior to their IPO that will help essentially these home lenders through any difficult situations. Like if we have another pandemic or market conditions, it does not bode well for them. They'll have this backup fund to keep operating, right? That's amazing. I've never seen anyone done that before. Airbnb is also thinking about listing on the long-term stock exchange in San Francisco, in addition to their possibly, I believe is in New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. I don't remember. But the long-term stock exchange was just, I think, authorized to have companies list earlier this year. in September. And that idea, you can read more about it, is from Eric Ries, who wrote The Lean Startup. It's calling for a responsible way to invest in companies and not just look at short-term profits. So I think Airbnb is leading with this example and being one of the biggest IPOs we'll see and one of the biggest startups in Silicon Valley. If you know they're successful in these endeavors, a lot of other startups will follow.
Love that answer. And I think one follow-up question to that is, obviously, you know, we're in a pandemic, COVID's hit. You're seeing this movement away from like these urban hubs, you know, across the world. What do you think the opportunity is for other tech ecosystems and other areas, if that's North America or other places around the world, have the ability to do now and take the good things from what's happened within San Francisco and Silicon Valley and apply it to their locations in order for them to build more successful tech ecosystems?
Yeah, I know I've been repeating this, but I've been loving all these questions. So if I could, if I'm thinking about exporting some of Silicon Valley's virtues onto other hubs, I think some of the things that I think we should really learn from, the first would be just the ability to kind of hustle, right? Hustling and grit and bias to action, you just have to have this. And this doesn't have to be in tech startups, right? If you want to start an ice cream company, if you want to start your own handmade handbag company, these are the qualities you have to have in order to run a successful business. I think another virtue that we want to take away is that Silicon Valley has a very collaborative and open ecosystem. And you want to host as many events as possible. You want to get people to meet up and network. That is the only way to create this kind of open source business and product conversation so that everybody can move forward. I think that's the second most important thing. What I hopefully you guys don't take away from Silicon Valley is putting a ping pong table in your office and thinking you're a startup. Right? There's a difference between the lifestyle as a result of your hard work versus just the lifestyle itself. And a lot of hubs may think that just because they have a really cool office party every month and they have wacky bikes or scooters in their office, which they have to spend a lot of money on instead of inputting operations, that they're suddenly a startup and they're going to change the world, right? Drop that. Start lean, right? Start with nothing and then slowly build towards that. Don't put that as the reason to attract talent, right? The talent should come because of your mission, not because of your foosball table. Another thing is, I think you should, every hub, because they're typically an urban area, should leverage what's unique about that city. So for Toronto, for example, I wouldn't imagine you want to copy the culture of San Francisco because it's very different. You want to leverage your local strengths and you want to build a niche group of customers who are very loyal at your base. And then once you have this, you can then expand. I don't think it's a winning strategy to immediately, if you're from, say, Canada, to think about, oh, how do I reach the market in Texas, right? The first thing you should think about is how do I reach the people around me, solve their problems, and then slowly expand outwards. These are some of the points I have on the top of my mind. Happy to go into more.
Yeah, no, they're great. I mean, they're the tough realities and something, there's a lot of hype that's created around startups, especially in the last decade or so. It just seems like the cool thing to do, but you sort of broke my heart a little bit when you're talking about the ping pong tables and all that, but you saved it after you said, build it up for a few years. Cause we just got our scooter and our ping pong table in the office like months ago and we really enjoy it. But it's been, 4 or 5 years of just absolute, maddening hustle and hard work. And yeah, I mean, company culture is important, but it really requires hustling in the beginning. But yeah, Peter, this was an awesome, amazing conversation. I learned a lot more about you than I thought I knew. And it was just, it's great to have you back at least for a little while here in Canada. Peter, where can people find you if they wanted to follow up and ask you questions, ask you about how to get involved in growth and growth marketing, LinkedIn, Twitter, where are you?
Yeah, please primarily just hit me up on LinkedIn. You can just find me. There's nobody with my last name, I think, in the world. Just Google Peter, Z-H-I. No one can ever pronounce it on LinkedIn. And I'm happy to just offer any advice to connect you with other people as well.
Awesome. Yeah, I think you're the only Peter I know as well. So. Cool. That's great. Well, thank you, Peter. I really appreciate it. Greg and I sure had a great great insight and great conversation. And everyone, we'll see you on the next episode of The Growth Equation. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you guys for having me.